KPFA local station for. We need to reach new listeners without alienating the current ones. Things are changing and radio is going digital in 2013. We should take advantage of this. KPFA will be able to broadcast on multiple channels with micro-local and foreign language broadcasting. Fundraising is an important duty of any nonprofit board. As one of the few independent candidates, I will work in a collaborative manner with all members. I grew up in a communal house in West Berkeley, studied broadcasting at Laney College, and run a small business in Oakland. Vote for me, Eve Ardeal.
KPFA is dying, in grave financial trouble, and we need your help. I am Terry Duran, running on the Save KPFA slate, a group committed to reversing the situation by making the local station board a collaborative instrument to support quality, well-produced radio that meets the needs of the broad progressive community. Vote for Terry Duran and the entire Save KPFA slate. Thank you.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. It's a minute past 1 o'clock. Stay tuned next for Terra Verde.
Amazon Basin, from the magnificent redwoods of California to the icy majesty of the Arctic, life on Earth faces an unprecedented threat from careless development. Join Terra Verde over lunch today to find out about the unfolding future of the planet.
Welcome to Terra Verde, a weekly environmental show on KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley or KFCF in Fresno. I'm your host, Adam Greenfield. Hello. Do you ever feel like for all the armies of non-profit organizations, the legions of so-called green products, the scientific research, international treaties and so on, that we're not really getting fundamentally closer to a more sustainable life? In fact, in a civilization characterized by resource extraction, what does sustainable or green really mean? Well, my guest today on Terra Verde argues that piecemeal responses to environmental degradation will never work. In fact, he advocates a far more fundamental shift in our view of industrial society and its place in the world. As one of the most outspoken critics of industrial economy, my guest is an activist and author of books that include The Culture of Make-Believe, Endgame, and How Shall I Live My Life? He's also gained recognition for his work, including Press Action Person of the Year for Endgame in 2006, and one of Utney Magazine's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing the World in 2008. Howard Zim called him a rare and original voice of sanity in a chaotic world. He has wisdom and wit, grace and style, and a wonderful guide to a good life beautifully lived. Well, I wish people said that about me. So, to discuss his opinions on the modern environmental movement and whether or not industrial civilization can ever be sustainable, we welcome to Terra Verde author and activist Derek Jensen. Derek, welcome to Terra Verde.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, let's start at the top. Most people's connection with environmentalism is the kind of buy green, you know, buy a green car, buy a green product. What do you make of that kind of message?
I think that it's pretty much a dead end, for a number of reasons. One of them is, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and several years ago, Stephanie McMillan and I did the book As the World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. And one of the parts of the genesis of that book was was Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth, where he lays out very many strong statements about global warming, and that's all pretty good until you get to the end when all the solutions that he suggests are things like changing light bulbs, inflating your tires, and so on. And if everyone in the United States did every one of the things that he suggested, it would reduce carbon emissions by, I think, about 19%, which is great, but he doesn't speak out against a growth economy. And even if an economy grows 2% per year, that's all wiped out pretty quickly. And besides which, the scientific consensus is that carbon emissions need to be reduced by like 70%. And so what ends up happening is all this personal lifestyle choice is distraction. It's like a stage magician, you know, but, you know, talking and pointing in one direction while the real action is happening somewhere else. And a great example of that is that, you know, trash production. Let's say that you really want to reduce trash production because, of course, you know, trash production in the United States is just entirely out of hand and around the industrialized world, really. And so let's say you reduce your trash production to zero. The average person in the United States produces about 2,000 pounds per year, 1,500 pounds, 2,500 pounds, somewhere in there of trash per year. So let's say you reduce that to zero. You know, you wear your tennis shoes till they're falling off your feet. You fix your toaster. You don't buy anything that has packaging. All that stuff. You reduce to zero. Great. Well, the problem is that actual U.S. production of trash per person is about 25 tons, and 97% of it is produced by agriculture and industry. And it's the same with water consumption. We hear, oh my gosh, you know, we're running out of water, so we have to take shorter showers. But the problem is that 90% of the water used by human beings is used by agriculture and industry. And the same amount of water is used for municipal golf courses as is used by municipal human beings. So if you really want to leverage your efforts, what you should do is take out golf courses. And my point is that, I'll say one more thing about this, which is that years and years and years ago, I was complaining to an American Indian friend of mine. It's like, oh my gosh, I drive a car. I'm responsible for global warming. And she looked at me really sternly and she said, okay, take responsibility for what you do, but you didn't create car culture. If you really want to stop global warming, you need to stop car culture. And another way to say this is that you can't solve social problems with purely personal solutions. I live pretty cheaply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. You know, it's not a political statement. And nobody would think that you can stop an oppressive power by purely personal actions. If we put this somewhere else, you know, if we're living in Nazi Germany, nobody's going to say, oh, if we just compost, that'll stop the Nazis, or it'll stop Stalin if we just ride a bike. So if we put it there, and nobody would think that, oh, okay, if I don't own a slave, that's actually going to stop chattel slavery. Or, you know, if I personally don't sexually assault a woman, that's going to stop, you know, the men's violence against women. No, we have to go beyond simply personal non-participation and move toward actual resistance to actually stopping the perpetrators. And one more thing, and I know I said it like four times now, but one of the things that's notably absent in An Inconvenient Truth and in so many movies like that is a recognition that we don't live in a democracy and that and a recognition of corporate power. And that's one of the things that makes it very disingenuous for those personal solutions to be suggested in lieu of organized political resistance. Like a friend of mine says, that the role of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The role of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power.
So Derek, basically what you're saying is it's not so much you know, personal choice lifestyle as in identifying the framework of power that exists and challenging that framework.
I think that probably you should be interviewing yourself, because you just said in one sentence what it took me like 5 minutes to say. So you articulated it beautifully.
Well, thank you very much. But, I mean, what you know, I've read Endgame, which is your roughly 1,000-page challenge to civilization. And, you know, it does, you argue at great length, which something which can be summed up as love does not imply pacifism. You spend a while debunking in your mind, I guess, the myth that pacifism is always the way to go and violence is never appropriate. But, you know, frankly, to a lot of people, that's a really disturbing notion. That violence actually has a role in confronting this situation. you can't really sugarcoat that to people, can you?
I'm sorry, I missed the very last sentence.
I said you can't really sugarcoat that issue that you're advocating, you know, violence as maybe not the only solution, but a part of it.
Well, it's certainly not the only solution, but I do think that it... Right now, the world's being murdered. 150 to 200 species are going extinct today, and I don't see how... and if things continue as they are, well, we'll get to where things are going, and we need to put every option on the table. And when we talk about militant resistance, we need to recognize that only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. You know, 98% was either above-ground work or various material support. And what we need is a well-rounded movement of resistance that includes all includes at least a consideration of all possible tactics. And, you know, in everyday life, people understand this, that they understand that if someone breaks into your home and is standing over you with an axe, that it, you know, might just be okay to, you know, pull a gun out and shoot them. That people recognize when it comes to that level of personal violence, you know, we have to stop Ted Bundy. I think we would all agree that it would not be acceptable. Even the most, you know, even the most dogmatic pacifists would agree that Ted Bundy needed to be removed from society. And whether or not he was killed or whether or not he was put into a prison cell for the rest of his life is really immaterial to this question, because he's not going to walk into a jail cell intentionally. You need to have force to remove him from society. Everybody would recognize that there are sociopaths who... every culture has to have a way to deal with sociopaths. And unfortunately, within a capitalist system, what it does with sociopaths is promotes them to CEO or president or head of the Senate or, you know, whatever. It gives them positions of power because of the reward system of this culture. And so there is no accountability. That's one of the things that needs to happen, is there is no accountability for the powerful. And that accountability needs to come from a communal level. We need to say, look, you are not going to destroy the planet. Well, one of the things I talk about a lot is that my definition of bringing down civilization is depriving the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and depriving the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. And, you know, nobody but a capitalist could really argue with that. And, okay, how are you going to do that? And that's the question. You know, we can do it through mass movements. We can do it through, if we don't have mass movements, the question is, how do we lever power? Because that's really the only thing they're going to understand. And voting is certainly one way, and that's a very small lever. And voting with your dollars, as they say, which is an admission that the whole, that the regular democracy is defunct. Oh, I want to say one more thing about that, too, which is very interesting, which is that in the 1980s was the first time corporate newspapers called people consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that redefinition is really important in terms of what is available to us as members of a resistance or in terms of resisting. But I'm sort of getting off your point. Yeah, I think that we need to keep all options open, which doesn't mean also, by the way, that individually anybody has to choose to participate in militant resistance. Two great examples of that having to do with Quakers are that Harriet Tubman carried a gun, and she fought in the Union Army, and she was not a pacifist at all. And she worked with Quakers, and Quakers were absolutely crucial to the Underground Railroad. And another story I heard just recently was that the Black Panthers were looking for a place to have a meeting, and they were under so much pressure from the cops at that point that any meeting they would have would be unsafe. And Quakers offered a meeting house and said, we will surround the house with our bodies because the cops won't shoot us.
It's pretty impressive stuff. So,
which doesn't mean that the Quakers were violating their own personal code of nonviolence.
Sure. Well, Derek, let's just bringing it back to the personal level. You know, I think a lot of people that read Endgame, you know, kind of go through that period afterwards of being very disturbed, and perhaps they look around at everything and think, wow, if civilization and technology is inherently unsustainable, then everything I'm looking at is wrong. I think that could lead in many people to a feeling of despair, at least for a while. Have you been through that experience, or do you go through it now, and how do you deal with that?
Well, that's another wonderful question, and yeah, I go through that despair quite often, and that grieving, and I went through it in a major, major way in my 30s, about 15 years ago, and it was really important to have friends around with whom I could, you know, cry about this. And friends, you know, I remember one conversation with a friend where I called up and I was just sobbing, and I said, you know, this work's killing me. I'd been an activist for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years at that point. This work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, it'll do that. And I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. And I said, the dominant culture has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was so wonderful is because it normalized my despair. That let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. That let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain. And it wasn't so much the sorrow and pain that hurt as it was my resistance to it. That let me know that I could feel all those things, all the sorrow and rage and joy. And I didn't have to fight those. I could feel those, and it wouldn't kill me. And then there's something even better happened, which is I could feel all those things, and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't really touch you anymore. And what I mean by that is that what I found, I'd been so afraid of feeling all those things because I thought that my whole personality would fall apart. But the truth is that what fell apart was my faith in the system. And once I lost the faith in the system, it's like, okay, let's pick ourselves up and let's dust off our hands, roll up our sleeves, and see what other cliches I can throw in, and then get to work. And it's a wonderful thing, and it's wonderfully liberating, but it's a very painful process, and it's really important. You know, we can't do this alone. It's really important to have supportive friends that you can talk to and say, you know, on one hand, oh my gosh, I feel so bad about the Coho Salmon runs very, very small or something. I feel very bad about that. And to have somebody not go, well, who cares? But to have somebody feel bad with you. And on the other hand, to be able to say to somebody, yeah, the stock market went down 70 points today. It's like, yeah, score. The point is, it's really important to have people who will validate that, because it's not going to be validated by the culture at large. The message we get from the culture at large is, everything's okay, everything's okay, technology's going to save it, and we all know that's not true, and, you know, we can have it all, and you can continue to destroy the planet and live on it, and you keep getting that message. And somebody once said to me that in a culture of lies, simply hearing the truth is a tremendous gift. And I know that's been true for me. I remember, and I'll shut up in a second, I remember when I was 26 or 27, I was at a library, and this book jumped off the shelf at me. It was called The Natural Alien by Neil Everdon. And it was the first book I ever read that didn't take the utilitarian worldview as a given, that didn't take this notion that all of the natural world is here for us to use, but instead, the trees have lives of their own that's just as valuable to them as mine is to me, and so do salmon, and so do Delta smelt. And it was the first book I ever read that did not take that utilitarian worldview as a given. And it's a cliche again, but it's like this huge weight went off my shoulders. Like, I'm not crazy. The culture is the one that's crazy.
It's interesting, Derek, you talk about utopian visions, because I saw on the front of a science magazine recently one of those utopian visions of cities, you know, the sleek, shiny metal skyscrapers. And it's, you know, those kind of visions are still really, really popular today in spite of everything that's happening. You know, people are definitely highly influenced by visions. Do you think it's important to create a new vision that people can move towards that is perhaps a smarter direction to go in? I mean, I don't know if you've heard of the transition movement, which is a peak oil post-carbon resiliency movement, but one of the big elements of that is the is the visioning. You know, if what we've got right now is unsustainable, then what's the vision to move towards? Do you agree with that?
Well, I think it is important to have some sort of vision, and for me it's also really important that the vision includes, people ask me what I want, I say a couple things. One is I say, well, what isn't so important what I want, what's important is what the real world wants and what the real world is going to give us, what reality is. And the other thing I say about that is that, yeah, but the world that I want has more wild salmon every year than the year before, and has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and less dioxin every mother's breast milk every year than the year before. And so that, I think, is really important. And the thing that I find missing in a lot of those discussions that I think needs to be included is that the vision has to include the fact that those in power are sociopathological, and that we can come up with these visions. A great example of this is in the German resistance against Hitler in World War II, that there's this one member especially was pretty much a pacifist, Karl Gordeller, mayor of, I think, Leipzig, I'm not sure, and he was pretty much a pacifist, and one of the things, he's tremendously courageous, I'm saying nothing about his courage, but one of the things he did is he spent all this time drawing out what the government was supposed to look like after Hitler was removed, but he personally refused to have anything to do with any plot to assassinate Hitler. So he would skip that step, and he kept thinking, if I could just talk to Hitler, I could talk him out of this. And, you know, once again, in retrospect, we can recognize that that part's pretty crazy. Yeah, it's important to envision some future, but at the same time, we have to be fully cognizant that right now there is this anti-democratic, sociopathic set of institutions that are ripping the planet to pieces and ripping indigenous cultures to pieces, ripping the poor to pieces, and so on. And we need to recognize that's part of what we need to do. Part of what we need to do is to envision a future that we want, and part of it also is to envision the present in all of its fully horrific state and figure out what we're going to do about that. Because we could fantasize all we want about some, you know, groovy eco-village, and I mean, once everything comes down, once the whole economy goes down, of course I'm first in line knocking on the eco-village's doors asking for food, so I'm not attacking them. But at the same time, we can fantasize about the groovy eco-village, but what happens if there are resources discovered in that eco-village that those in power want? We all know, you know, suddenly uranium or oil or gold is discovered on that. We all know what happens, which is the land is seized and anybody who resists is faces state repression. And we need to face up to that. It's like I was on this panel years ago, and all of us on the panel, it was Vanda Shiva, Kathy Pedler, this nun whose name I never can remember, does great anti-war work. All of us on the panel will recognize that we don't live in a democracy. Great. Everybody in the audience recognizes we don't live in a democracy. I mean, the question, you know, does the government take better care of corporations or human beings? Duh. You know, we don't live in a democracy. Everybody on the panel recognizes this, but all of us are talking in our own activism as though we live in a democracy. And at one point I turned to the nun and I said, she's doing this great anti-war work, I said, look, if you were trying, at the time it was the invasion of Iraq, I said, if you were trying to stop the invasion of Iraq and you recognize we don't live in a democracy, how would that change your actions? I said, I have no idea. And most of us have no idea because we haven't really internalized the fact that we don't live in a democracy, that we live in a government of occupation. Of course, my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? but what would happen if we fully internalize that understanding? How would that affect our resistance? I want to say one more thing, sorry, that, you know, we were talking about the IRA before. One of the things that was really important to their movement was not merely deciding to fight, but in addition, there's like Maud Gunn, who was an actress, who was part of the Gaelic literature revival. All of that stuff is really important too, to have different forms of literature, to have different forms of plays, to have different forms of at this point film, to have different forms of art. Art has always been very important to building cultures of resistance. And so that's one thing. Yeah, we can talk about a culture of resistance, but that doesn't necessarily just mean picking up a gun. It means envisioning this future. And it means, you know, using various art forms. It means using the radio as a form of resistance.
Well, Derek, we're almost out of time, but very briefly, for those who are listening out there, you know, thinking about the things we're talking about, what's the next step?
Well, the next step individually is for, the big distinction is never between those who are militant and those who are not. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do not. So what I would suggest is, or a couple things. One is that people find what they love. You know, whether it's the integrity of women's bodies, and so they want to stop men's violence against women, or whether it's, you know, some specific creature, fairy shrimp, delta smelt, doesn't matter. Find some place, and then defend it. And the next thing is to, what are your gifts, and how can you best use them in the service of your community, including the land base? What are your gifts? And I'm a terrible organizer, you know, but I'm a good writer. And the final thing is, the problem is so overwhelming, but just do a little bit at a time to start. That when I first started as an activist, the story takes like 30 seconds. When I first started as an activist, it was because I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. And every time I would fill a tank with gas, I would either give dollar for dollar to a local environmental organization, or since I didn't have any money, what I would do is I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism, because it's so big I can't do anything. But if I spent $10 on gas, sure, I can do 2 hours this week. And I started doing that, and I started having so much fun with the activism that I stopped keeping track, because it was just, the activism itself became the end. But so that's a really good way to just, like, get a start. So start somehow.
Okay, well, Derek, thank you very much for joining us. It was a pleasure talking with you, and all the best with your work.
Well, thank you. Same to you, and it was a great interview.
Thank you. Well, we hope you'll join us next week on Terra Verde. This show and others are available at www.kpfa.org. I'm Adam Greenfield, and I will see you soon. Have a great weekend.
The following candidate statements belong to the author of the statement only.
My name is Ivar Deal. I am 30 years old and running for the KPFA local station board. We need to reach new listeners without alienating the current ones. Things are changing and radio is going digital in 2013. We should take advantage of this. KPFA will be able to broadcast on multiple channels with micro-local and foreign language broadcasting. Fundraising is an important duty of any nonprofit board. As one of the few independent candidates, I will work in a collaborative manner with all members. I grew up in a communal house in West Berkeley, studied broadcasting at Laney College, and run a small business in Oakland. Vote for me, Ivar Deal.
KPFA is dying, in grave financial trouble, and we need your help. I am Terry Duran, running on the Save KPFA slate, a group committed to reversing this situation by making the local station board a collaborative instrument to support quality, well-produced radio that meets the needs of the broad progressive community. Vote for Terry Duran and the entire Save KPFA slate. Thank you.
This is a reminder to our listeners that ballots for your local station board elections have been mailed. The candidate statements will be mailed shortly after you receive your ballot. You can also access the statements online at PacificaElection2010.org. If you are a listener member of KPFA and have not received your ballot by September 1st, please call your local election supervisor at 510-332-7181 or email at less pacifica.org to request a new ballot. And please remember to vote. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.